call the Senate Finance Committee to order. It is 1:30 in the Senate Finance Room in the Capital City. Present Senator Stedman, Senator Keel, Senator Merrick, Senator Kaufman, Senator Cronk, and myself, Senator Hoffman. Please silence your cell phones. We have a quorum to conduct business. We have one item on today's agenda, which is HB 78, Retirement Systems Defined Benefits. We probably won't get through the bill completely since we only have half an hour today. We're going to be adjourning a little bit after 2 o'clock because of schedule conflicts. With that, the first item, as I said, was HB 78, Retirement Systems Defined Benefit Options. This is the first hearing on this bill, as I invite the prime sponsor, Representative Kopp, to the table and bring anyone with him that he needs support from, introduce the bill and tell us what it does to people that are working for the state of Alaska.
Thank you, Chair Hoffman, members of the committee. It's a privilege to be here today and present to you this policy proposal. Mr. Chairman, I first want to ground the discussion before we jump into the slides and address a critical distinction I think that matters. There are two very different cost conversations that often get conflated when we talk about pensions. The first is Alaska's legacy pension liability, and that liability comes from retirement tiers that we closed nearly 20 years ago. It's already locked into statute, it's amortized on a closed schedule, and projected to be paid off around 2039. And that obligation exists whether House Bill 78 passes or not. House Bill 78 does not add $1 to that legacy debt. The second conversation, and the one before us today, is the cost of future service, how Alaska compensates and retains the workforce that we depend on going forward. The state's actuary, Gallagher, testified in House Finance Committee last April, evaluating House Bill 78 using the same conservative assumptions, statutory contribution caps, and funding rules that we already have in the law. And under that analysis, the normal cost of the plan, defined benefit here, is about 10% of payroll for PERS and about 9.5% for TERS, well below what we are paying today to contribute to the legacy tiers. As we walk through these slides, the key takeaway is this. Alaska is already paying for its past. The policy choice before us is whether we continue paying the escalating and largely invisible costs of workforce failure, or whether we invest in a disciplined and shared risk way in a retirement system that stabilizes our workforce and brings long-term predictability back to the budget. So the next slide. So this slide, Mr. Chairman, just highlights what we already know. The workforce recruitment and retention problems are everywhere in state government. It's not isolated, it's systemic. Nearly every one of the commissioners has said retaining a skilled workforce is a real problem in keeping experienced staff. The quote here highlighted from our state auditor shows us that audit findings are one of our biggest government failures, and it's tied directly to our workforce instability. The findings, as you see here from Chris Curtis, our state auditor, is that we had nearly 90 most recently. Several of us heard the auditor break this down for us. Basically, she said, we're losing experienced staff and our compliance is breaking down. That increases our operational risk. For instance, Mr. Chairman, our auditor said we had one grant in the FY24 statewide audit that was a disaster grant for which the state was eligible to be reimbursed from the federal government $280 million that we did not ask for reimbursement, largely because of an operational breakdown. Just the interest on not asking for that is $1.4 million a month. Where we're at on that now, I don't know if we receive that money back. But it's an example, if you don't have the operational experience to know how to do a job, it does hurt the state. Again, a stable, experienced workforce does promotes program integrity and protects the state and the federal resources. So this just gives some context and fiscal framing to what we're discussing. Next slide. The legacy plans, as we saw this morning and on other previous days before this committee and the House Finance Committee, are recovering. They're stable. TERS is at 80%. PERS is at 70%. Payments toward the legacy planned liability are larger now, but the liability is reducing more rapidly. And according to the Arm Board, we're on track for around a 2039 payoff. House Bill 78, again, does not reopen the legacy tiers. And I just wanted to highlight here that our investment returns have exceeded expectations. To thank the people at the Department of Revenue for that.
Senator Stedman.
Just a point. I think earlier this morning we had a presentation on PERS and TERS. TERS has the same liability it had in 2015 as it has in 25. They had the same numeric, so we didn't gain anything, and we spent a couple billion bucks going nowhere. SBS moved a little bit, but not much. We can certainly rejuvenate those letters or those numerics, but we talked about that. That was after the $2 billion infusion into TERS and the $1 billion infusion into PERS. So I would not couch this last decade as gaining much ground on the unfunded liability. It certainly wasn't reflected here a couple hours ago on the table.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Please proceed.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman. So just in reply, thank you, Senator Stedman, for pointing that out. So our fiscal choices have not always done us well. In 2014, we went to a level percent of payroll due to House Bill 385, which was introduced less than 2 weeks to go to the end of the session, passed both bodies unanimously. And that stretched out the amortization schedule and changed us from a level dollar pay to a level percent of payroll. And the state's actuary for the Arm Board, Gallagher, said that will cost you $5 billion in additional unfunded liability to do this. But we defaulted at that time towards reducing our short-term liability to stretch it out longer. And it did, in fact, cause us to be more slow on the front end. They predicted 8 more years of increasing liability before it peaked and started coming down. And I think clearly we're on the downward slide now. This next slide, Mr. Chairman, shows what's happening with our workforce, the defined contribution activity, employee behavior. What are we doing? It shows that we are cashing out $160 million a year in PERS and TERS, the employees are. And if you add their supplemental annuity and deferred compensation plan, it's nearly $500 million every year in cash outs. And most of those are happening when employees hit the 5-year of service or are 100% vested when they can take their employer and employee contributions. This is the most recent pie chart of our state workforce, showing that most of our employees are in that 1 to 4 year churn. And exactly what our commissioners are telling us, that we're not keeping people in the workforce pipeline for a career. We're incentivizing more of a cash-and-go day labor plan. Next slide.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stedman.
Again, we had presentations here at the previous legislature from legislative finance over employee turnover, and there was no discernible difference in the plans. We can bring that all back and take a look at that. But in just inferring that that's the only issue is the retirement plan, I would argue that it has a lot more to do with salaries, daycare, and ability to buy a home and housing. So it's a much more complicated formula. And we can revisit that, Mr. Chairman, with Ledge Finance if they can update that data set.
We'll get that. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do recall that same presentation, and of course Legislative Finance acknowledged the information that they didn't have and some of the assumptions they had to make, like assuming once somebody left a PERS employer, they had left PERS forever. But when you compare that to what the actuaries actually have and the numbers they put in the PERS financial reports, in fact, there's a huge difference in turnover, and the retention is much better with the defined benefit. But if we want to get those restated, I'd love to see those restated with all the data in them.
We can certainly do that. Senator Olson.
Representative Scott, would you stick to speak to Bert Stedman's comment?
In response?
Yes, through the chair, Senator Olson, thank you. This morning, indeed, at 8 a.m. in front of the House Education Committee, the deed commissioner said they're experiencing 28% turnover in the teacher workforce statewide. We are seeing significant turnover that is just, it's an observable behavior that's documented. And I wouldn't take issue either with Senator Stedman's recommendations that we improve child care and salaries. I mean, those things are all important. But as far as turnover, our own commissioners are documenting very significant high rates of turnover. Thank you. Going on to the retirement system and just kind of making this point, Mr. Chairman, this is the slide that DRB showed us just last week in front of this committee and in front of House Finance. What I think is really interesting when we look at this is 80% of today's active PERS and TERS employees are in the defined contribution plan, but they're only producing 1% of the retirees statewide. 99% of our retirees are coming from the closed defined benefit system. And this tells us the issue is not just timing. It's that the current system is not retaining employees long enough to reach retirement, which is the workforce problem that House Bill 78 is intending to address. And we're hearing this from our commissioners. We're seeing it from the turnover. We're not filling up the pipeline. Thank you. Next slide. So the proposal under this plan, Mr. Chairman, is in light of what our current system is providing us, is a system that lowers costs and improves service. We look at it as a strategic workforce investment. It should be emphasized that this involves separate accounting. The pensions and the health care trusts are separate from the legacy pension trusts. In front of House Finance Committee, our state actuary, Mr. Kirshner, said that this plan is going to help future retention. It's going to help lower future turnover. It's because people are incentivized to stay, receive benefits in an environment that produces these types of outcomes, and that's consistent with the actuary's interpretation. Next slide. Here we see how the employee contributions work. In PERS and TERS, employees have an adjustable rate which keeps the plan healthy. They share in the risk and the stability, and it protects against underfunding. It's 8 to 12% based on a 90% funding threshold. This is the gold standard nationwide amongst pension health funds. We went with that standard because we want the trusts to react live to the market. If there's poor market returns, we want the contributions to go up. So employees share the risk. They start at 8%, but you can see there's quite a range it can go up where they can contribute more during poor market returns. I would point out that our actuary says that all of their projections, in all of them, they're not projecting the HB 78 subtrusts come anywhere near the 90% level. They're starting at 100%. Starting well-funded, of course. So here we show states that use a variable employee contribution rate.
We have a question from Senator Kaufman.
Yes.
Thank you. Through the chair to the bill sponsor, if you would just explain the mechanism by which we start out 100% funded.
Yes. Thank you for the question, Senator Kaufman, through the chair. There has to be an actuarially fair transfer. In other words, the buy-in has to be equivalent to the value of a defined benefit pension plan that you're buying into. So a DC account will be evaluated based on the benefits it's buying going into a defined benefit system. And there will be a transfer made that ensures the system is fully funded. Now, what that means is that Not every employee will get a one-to-one transfer. Defined benefits are more valuable. It is a lifetime pension where the longevity risk, will I outlive my income, is shared with the employer where it's all on the employee in a defined contribution. And the investment risk is shared, we can see here shared, versus it all being on the employee. So, and there's also disability benefits in House Bill 78 like we had before. Right now, for instance, if an officer is hurt on duty, they immediately go from their pay to 40% of their base pay, and they lose all their health care. It's not something I think the legislature ever intended, but that is the way it is right now. We look at that, the occupational disability, the non-occupational disability, and go back to how it was. So the benefits are more valuable, is what I'm saying, in a defined benefit plan. And the actuary's job is to make sure that when you buy into that plan, if you have $100,000 in your DC account, that you get $100,000 of DB benefits. Will that equivalent to a year-for-year service transaction? Maybe for some it will, and maybe for some it'll be more like a multiplier.
Senator Kaufman.
Thank you, through the chair. I'm going to have to unpack that a little bit later. So if you have two employees and one, like most state employees, has two accounts, or perhaps even three. So they've got their defined contribution, they've got their SBS, and then whatever they may have been putting into what's really the Roth fund as far as income goes. So compared to, let's say, somebody in education who only has the defined contribution plan right now because they have been opted out of the equivalent of Social Security, whether it's SBS, Social Security. So there's a piece missing there. So you have two unequal entrants into this as you plan to sweep these funds into the plan and then offer the pension. Can you explain how that works? I get the sense that there's not going to be equality in there because there's two different starting points.
So there has to be an actuarially fair transfer. In other words, the benefits that you're buying have to equal the amount that you're bringing to the table. And that is something best I would defer to Mr. Kirshner, whoever the state's actuary is on that. Now, you mentioned teachers. So the state actually contributes at a higher rate to the teacher as employees. They contribute at 8%. Match, and they give 5% to PERS. So teachers do get a bigger bump in there, but again, whether you're a teacher or whether you're a regular PERS employee, the size of your account has to match exactly what the defined benefit is. From what we can look at, it's going to be what we hope is many of our employees will be a one-to-one transfer. We know some will have excess that have done well, and they can just they can bank that money, keep it in their savings, and some can go on a payroll. The bill provides for a payroll pay plan where you can just pay over time. Like if you come in and they say you can buy 90% of your years of service, but not 100%, do you want to go on a payroll pay plan or do you want to do a one lump sum? There's options for employees to square it up so they're year for year for service. And some employees may decide to stay in the DC plan. This doesn't force any employee to leave the plan that they're in.
Brief in. Meeting back to order, Senator Stedman.
Maybe I can help clarify a little bit because I heard some muddling here that crossing wires. Supplemental benefit system is a different issue. You're not going to be able to move that around. What we're talking about is the defined contribution plan. And if you're in a surplus, you're actually further ahead in the defined benefit plan than you would be the defined contribution. And you'd have that opportunity then to go into the lesser plan, and we'll get into what we do with the surplus later on. the and if you're in a, say you were in the stable value fund, which is basically a money market account, and you don't, you know, it's not an investment account, and you haven't accumulated much, then you'd be at a deficit, and then we can talk later in the plan on how, if you're in a deficit, how you could gain back that defined benefit. But and then TERS is not in SPS or Social Security, and that's the teachers on their own accord. Right? So that gap is still in existence. There is some police and fire that are also not in SPS or Social Security. That's at a local issue. That is not the state. And there hasn't been any communities that I know of, cities that have come forward and asked to change the plan. The communities could put in their own plan if they want to, or they can do deferred comp or do other mechanisms to cover that gap. But all of the state employees are in SPS or Social Security. That is not the same at the local level, even in my own district. So there's some clarifications that we need to work on as we go forward. What's the responsibility of the state? What's the responsibility of City Hall? And also the liability, how it can flow from City Hall to the state. We saw that this morning with the cap at 22%, with the contribution rate at 27.55.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Senator Kaufman.
Through the chair, thank you for that. It's part of what I've been puzzling over is where do all the streams of money come from? And that was helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So continuing with the employee contribution, I think we've talked about that. The employees share the risk. And then we also want to show the employees' contribution. Oh, the states that also have shared risk. So we're not alone. These are other states that do that on a smaller scale. We have an 8 to 12 range to increase the capacity to absorb downturns. Going to the employer contribution, we stay with what is currently the cap now for PERS. Local governments are capped at 22%, with the state paying any additional liability above 22% on behalf of local government. And we stay with TERS capped at 12.56. Now, what is significant here is we set a floor of 12. Now, how did we get that? Well, Mr. Chairman, it's because the plan itself, once the legacy pension debt is paid off, is projected again for PERS to be just a little over 10%, and for TERS about 9.5%. So that still gives us a cushion for a very well-funded plan, and it's something a future legislature can visit if they think that the floor is too high. But the state in this bill maintains the existing liability past the service costs above the 22%. And the employee-employer contribution is synced. So if the actuaries say, hey, we need to go from 8 to 8.1, then there will be for the employees, then the employers will also have a 0.1 increase. Again, it's a shared risk plan. Next slide.
Senator Stedman.
Yes, Mr. Stedman.
Senator Stedman. We're just getting into this plan, and the complexities will get pretty substantial, I'm sure. But the 22%, I'm really curious on that, because that was put in place to protect the cities from going broke. First one would have went under would have been Fairbanks, and followed by many others, if not the vast majority of our cities. So the state came in and capped the contribution at 22%. Right now, I think it's 27.55, if I remember right, this morning, somewhere in there. I'm not sure, Mr. Chairman, that the state should be putting on the table accumulating additional liabilities from City Hall. The state, under the old plans, took on that liability mostly because of the accounting quagmire and the inability to get an accurate account per city. So we pooled them and came up with a numeric at 22%. The state would take everything over that, high enough to get the City Hall's attention, but low enough not to bankrupt them. I'm not interested personally of the state going forward in any plan whatsoever of taking liabilities from City Hall. City Hall should be responsible for their own liabilities. Because we in our plans, they're constitutionally protected from a diminishment in benefit, so it's a one-way door. So I think that needs to be considered as we go through this. why this plan is tied into the 22%.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman. So just going back to this plan, House Bill 78, it is not projected to add any new unfunded liability, not $1 more to the legacy debt. Now, to the policy call that you rightfully bring up, should we pay above the cap? This, in fairness to local government, their perspective is the Mercer debacle when we got bad actuarial advice back in 2002, 2001, 2003, whatever that was, and the state submitted a claim against Mercer in the range of $1.8 to $2.8 billion is what the state claimed its loss was. Well, we know what the time value of that money is. Just today, it would be over $5 billion. We collected $500 million. I think about $400 million actually ended up in our account by the time we paid the attorneys off and everything. So that really set us back. Local government was shocked because they were told by the state that they either didn't have to contribute during those years or severely under-contributed, and then we know what happened. They got their actual bill. It was very high. They said, hey, can we have a guaranteed rate that's survivable? And it was a shared risk between the state and local government. It's not like they were getting away with something. It was, we need these cities to be viable. We can't have them going bankrupt, and it's worked well to this point. And I would just say that even with that legacy debt, it is something we all are excited about going away, and it is going away. And in a short while, these plans are going to drop down to 10 and 9.5% of payroll if we go with something like this.
Please proceed.
Okay, the next, just continuing with the structure, the vesting period is 5 years for PERS and TERS, and it matches the prior DB tiers. It encourages people to stay, whether you're a teacher or a general public employee, it's a 5-year vesting period. This is qualifications for retirement. What does that look like? These are just reasonable, realistic retirement ages. It protects our teachers and public safety workforce, and it honors long-term service. We want to incentivize people staying in the workforce by working careers here in Alaska. And so if you're TERS or non-public safety PERS, you have to be 60 years old with a minimum of 5 years service, or at 30 years of service, you can collect your pension. For PERS public safety, age 50 with 25 years of service, or 55 with 20 years of service. A little bit shorter for public safety because the job takes, frankly, a lot out of them. So the structure, this is how the benefit structure works, is there's the multiplier. You get 2% of your high 5 years, this is not based on the high 3, but the high 5 years, for your first 10 years and 2.5% thereafter. So if you work 20 years, you'll be at 45%. And then you can do the math there, and you can see for teachers, you're at 42.5 if you work 20 years, or all the way up to 67.5% if you work 30 years. That's just how the multipliers work. Again, it's based off your 5 years high salary. And the next slide actually highlights how the average salary is computed to get into that for PERS and TERS. Next slide.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stedman.
A couple quick points. When we did the new tiers 20 years ago, we didn't want to have 4 employees doing the same job at 4 different levels, tier 1, tier 2, tier 3, and then come in with tier 4. So we tried to match the new tier, defined contribution, to benefits at Tier 3, which is, I think, similar to what's taking place here, trying to keep everything level, which is a positive. I just want to remind the folks of where we came up with these values. The other thing that shouldn't go unnoticed is the state of Alaska has a very rich retirement plan, very rich. And nobody wants to talk about it at the table, but it is. And then when you add SBS, Supplemental Benefit System, after 30 years, you have 100% salary replacement. There's people in this room that have pushing $1 million in their SBS account and over. So we have a very, very wealthy or a very rich and competitive retirement plan. And the TERS system, from what I've seen, is ranked number 11 in the nation. We're not in the top 10. We're number 11. And that's with the current structure. So there is a lot of indigestion in some categories at the local level because the municipalities have shorted their employees by not having them in Social Security or SBS. It takes out about a third of the retirement. Just want to make that note again, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, I believe that we should do something to surface that information so that we have an accurate assessment of the current situation and the gaps. What I've seen is the teacher situation is not well understood, and it often gets neglected that there's a piece missing there, so part of the problem that needs to be solved is there. And the retention issue seems to be the driver for this. I think what we should be working on is a sustainable retirement plan that takes into account what we're able to do and takes kind of the best case examples of what we're doing right now, gets it on the table, looks at it, and then we can see whether or not this proposal is actually the best way to go.
Thank you. With that, everyone at this table knows, but for the listening audience, Senator Stedman does have legislation in to try to fix the teachers' lack of funding under SBS. Please continue.
Thank you, Chair Hoffman. Next, just briefly addressing that retirees also have skin in the game. There is no cost of living allowance. We had that under the previous legacy tiers. That's when you're 265, you get an additional 10% of your base pension. That is gone. And that helped keep the plan solvent. It may not be viewed as fair, but actuarially it's very, very sound. The next slide, we also see how retirees have skin in the game. This is inflation-proofing.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Stedman, on the previous slide.
Yes, on the previous slide. I'd just like to note one of the goals was not to diminish benefits previously. We can argue if the defined benefit is good or bad, go around circles all day long. But clearly the intent was to match up with Tier 3 and not diminish benefits. And what I'm hearing today, this legislation diminishes benefits. And there's no reason the state of Alaska should be diminishing benefits. In fact, we've always talked about increasing them, increasing salaries, doing this TERS, SBS for TERS, and telling City Hall to quit being cheapskates and get them in Social Security or SBS. Let's not diminish benefits.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Please continue.
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Stedman, that warms my heart. But I agree with you. We shouldn't diminish benefits. But we're also trying to bring forward a plan that the actuaries say is very responsible and, in fact, will not add one additional dollar to unfunded liability. Thank you, Senator Hoffman.
Mr. Chairman. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm trying to make sure we're putting our comparisons in the right places. So to the sponsor, the current defined contribution system, does that have a cost of living adjustment for living in Alaska when you're 65?
No, it's all through the chair, Senator Keel. It's all what you have in your defined contribution account. That's what you live off of, but there's no pension per se. Whatever annuity you can buy is what you can buy.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
So, Mr. Chairman, again, with retirees with skin in the game, this is inflation-proofing. This bill is structured so the inflation-proofing, which is tied to Anchorage CPI right now, and that can go away or be reduced significantly if the fund valuation drops below 90%. The actuaries say this is a very strong vehicle to keep it well-funded. We see that Nebraska, South Dakota, and Wisconsin do this, and that's their current funding levels of their plans. They're all 100% or more funded, again, sharing the risk. Next slide. The medical coverage, something important to all of us, is consistent with the DC plan. We did make some improvements that were actuarially well-founded and encouraged by the ARM board. Employees no longer must retire directly from the plan. This came from the requirement of reaching your years of service. If you were a teacher, you could take 30 years, or public safety officer, and you could work 25 years. But you also had to retire directly into Medicare, which meant you had to be 64 years of age and on the job and retire exactly at 65. And that was something that was uniformly agreed was not a good practice for encouraging our employees to hang in there and get their benefits. So this changes that, again, looking at what's in the current DC plan and in proposed also in House Bill 78, and says, no, if you have your full time in service, you have vested in your health retirement account and your Alaska supplemental health care card when you turn Medicaid eligible at 65. Now, what the ARM board recommended is that not only to, if you're fully vested in the plan, that you don't have to come back at 64 and beg someone for a job to retire at 65, but also that we drop the PERS and TERS mandatory service of 30 years to 25 years for just the health care vesting purpose. Because the health trusts are so overfunded, and for public safety to drop it from 25 to 20 years, the ARM board actuary ran this, and it was still a very overfunded, well-funded plan by dropping those numbers by 5 years and saying, if you're a teacher at 25 years, you're fully vested in your health plan, and you have access to your HRA to bridge you to Medicare, and you get your Alaska supplemental health care plan at 65. So those are employee-friendly positions, actuarially responsible, recommended by the ARM board, and they're adopted in this. Here we can see how the plan is funded for PERS and TERS. It's 3% of the total payroll of those classes. I'm sorry, 3% of the average payroll per year goes into their account, and for public safety employees, it's 4% of the average payroll goes into their account. Next slide.
Mr. Chairman. Senator Stedman.
Earlier today, we had a presentation, and we talked about this replacement of federal funds, the EGWIP or whatever the acronym was, which pushed the health care into a substantial surplus. The question at the table was, what happens when that goes away? So that's an open question out to get, for the departments to get back to us on. The other thing I would caution the members about is what helped sink the old plan is every time they got in, not every time, but when they were in the surplus, they increased benefits and lowered contributions and drove the plan underwater. And this is a one-way door. You can't take benefits back. So I would be very, very cautious when we start looking at the premium or the surplus in the health care until we hear from retirements and benefits about how secure they think that surplus actually is before we even take action in the operating budget, Mr. Chairman, on funding. It is a significant risk the way it looks.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Please proceed.
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Stedman. So actually the ARM board just evaluated the employee group waiver program subsidies, looking at our current funding. PERS, of course, health care is 132% funded, and TERS 139% funded. And if all the employee group waiver programs go away, they would still remain overfunded, PERS at 104% and TERS at 110%. So that's the latest hot off the press evaluation on that.
Senator Stedman?
From the ARM board, what I reference is the Retirement and Benefits Department. I think they may have a different opinion. We need to hear that.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Kopp, I want to make sure I'm understanding what your piece of legislation does. Do you propose a change to the PERS or TERS defined benefit health trust and what it pays for here, or is this strictly in the DC plans?
No, this would cover both our DC employees and our House Bill 78 employees. Again, we're not doing anything with the legacy pension. Just this plan and DC, it would affect those.
Senator Keel.
Quick follow-up. So might be the only place Senator Stedman and I are going to agree on this, but benefit enhancements after a defined benefit system is kicked off are dangerous as all get out. So it sounds like this bill is not making any benefit enhancements to the legacy defined benefit system. Am I understanding that right?
Through the chair, yes, Senator Keel, we are not making any benefit enhancements to the legacy defined benefit pension trust. Yes.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Please proceed.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman, Chair Hoffman. So the structure, current employees, this is how it would work, is any current state local government employee in the PERS or TERS would, that is hired after this bill becomes effective, would have 180 days to opt into the plan or retain their own. So 6 months to evaluate, am I better off in the defined contribution plan or do I want to enroll in the DB plan? New employees coming in after the effective date of this bill would be enrolled in the defined benefit plan. Just as I wrap up here, Senator Stedman, both internal and external pension reform surveys across the state show that Alaskans are strongly supporting this. And in all districts across the state, all regions, people recognize that we have a situation that needs to be addressed with our workforce. This was a Patinkin survey, and I think we probably all know from keeping in touch with our own districts that it's probably at least that today. Nothing's really changed. Internally, the state employee surveys, we have one that was done by the Department of Public Safety that shows 82% would prefer a defined benefit retirement. Of all 458 public safety employees surveyed, almost 97% of them that have a defined benefit wanted their defined benefit, and 3.3% would rather have a defined contribution. Of those in the defined contribution plan, 75.7% would prefer to be in the defined benefit and 22.9% in the defined contribution. So that just kind of tells us where our people at. But again,
Senator Kaufman, then Senator Stedman.
Thank you. Through the chair to the bill sponsor, so you have this opt-in, so that's you can elect to participate. And I'm just curious, does the amount of enrollment, the percentage of employees who opt in, does that affect the financials of the plan in any way?
So the actuary assumes 100% opt-in. They give us their most conservative number. That has resulted in an estimate of about $36 to $37 million additional state contributions to the state, and for state employees, about $50 million. So those would be, they assume everybody is going to go in, but they will also, and Mr. Kirshner should tell you himself, they recognize that not everybody will, and that would affect that. But they give us the most conservative scenario, which is everybody is going to elect to go into the DB.
Senator Kaufman.
Thank you, through the chair. I'm just curious, why wasn't there modeling with maybe different outcomes? I think 100% is optimistic. I know just my casual survey of some of the younger folks in the building, they're no on opting in right now. And I'm just curious, it seems like it would be good to model a few different outcomes or have a slider or something on that.
Sure. Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, or
Kaufman.
Kaufman, thank you. We'll get you that report. So Chiron testified in front of this committee, and they did that modeling last year. We'll get you a copy of that report. They ran, if you have fewer opt-in, it's a lower cost, but the actuaries give you a fully loaded cost, assuming 100%. So the numbers that Gallagher Consulting, the state's actuary, gives is a fully loaded number. I would say that it was also brought to both the House Finance Committee's attention and other committees that if turnover assumptions don't change and we still have turnover, actually the DB plan is far cheaper and we'll be saving hundreds of millions of dollars in the long run because the benefits are more valuable, and if people don't stay around to collect them, it's the better way to go. So if you don't think it's going to change turnover, then you should absolutely go forward with this plan because it's cheaper. But if it will, then there is an additional cost because people stay long enough to work a career, collect their benefits, get health care and things like that. But this slide here, Mr. Chairman, shows the cost of what we're doing
on
now.
On the previous slide, Senator Kaufman and Senator Stedman.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the previous slide, which
Senator
is
Kaufman, I think he's not finished
Kaufman.
Yet.
Kaufman.
Senator Kaufman.
The survey that was done, folks preferring a plan such as this, did they understand the situation with inflation proofing? I'm semi-retired. I do this, but I also have retirement funds. It's inflation proofing by grace of its growth rate versus my withdrawal rate and the amount that I leave behind to continue to grow, the base amount to deal with inflation. So thereby that plan is inflation proof. But when folks are thinking about enrolling in this, will they understand the inflation risk that they're signing up for?
Through the chair, yes, Senator Kaufman, all the details of the plan are provided structurally to each employee. That's why there's a six-month window to make the choice so that a proper analysis. It's not a take it or leave it. You can keep your defined contribution plan, and there's going to be a lot of education. Each employee will have an individual, worksheet, and they'll know what they're getting. It won't be a guess. And all the benefits and how the triggers work and the risk sharing would be explained.
Thank you, Senator Kaufman. Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I assume that on the slide showing the communities in the survey, I assume you have resolutions from all these cities supporting the defined benefit plan, and that you'll submit those to the committee?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, those weren't going to borough assemblies and city councils. Those were standard polling. I don't know how Patinkin does that, frankly, but no, I don't have resolutions from those entities.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I don't think there's a resolution from anybody supporting any of the cities supporting going back to a defined benefit. But the other question is, when are they going to update, or has it already been done to run the analysis to see who's overfunded relative to this plan or underfunded? And how what's the time frame on that? I'm kind of curious to see that myself, where that is.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, analysis to see which plan is overfunded or underfunded?
The current plan, defined contribution, we've got a figure out what the value is of the new plan. Say this is enacted, and I'm an employee. I want to see where I'm at in the defined contribution to see if I should go to the defined benefit. And I'm either going to be in surplus or minus, right? Odds are I'm not going to be at net zero.
Through the chair, Senator Stemmen, yes, great question. And that is something the ARM board actuary working with DRB would do for the employees should this become law. They would produce that evaluation. I can tell you that in good market returns, in good years like we had, employees would be in very good shape. In a down year, they'd be able to buy less. It's just intuitive. If your account balance is less, you can buy less DB benefits. If your DC account has had a good year, you're going to buy more DB benefits.
Senator Stedman.
Well, I think that needs to be run so we can see that analysis, Mr. Chairman. I'm trying to make a decision. Because as I recall, several years ago, there was another defined benefit bill in the other body, and when they ran that analysis, this is way before COVID, they were shocked at how many people were in surplus. And the last time we discussed performance in detail was at the bottom of the trough of COVID, and now the markets are more normalized, and we can all see it in our SBS accounts, including the presenter, if he looked at his SBS account.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It is always very tempting to just look at today's market and assume that it's the end of history, and it'll never be the other way again. But I'm glad we're having good conversations to make sure we make long-term decisions. When we're talking about this conversion rate, there is a historical precedent that we can look to, and it went the other direction because when Senate Bill 141 passed in 2005. If memory serves, and I'll ask you please, Representative, to correct me where I get this wrong, that it wasn't just an option for folks who were in defined benefit but hadn't vested yet. They had not just an option to convert to the brand new defined contribution plan, but an incentive. They were going to get a dollar-for-dollar match on their employee contributions to their DB account. My recollection is that there were about 8,000 or 10,000 eligibles and statewide 60 people converted. Is that right?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, that is my memory.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This slide here, Mr. Chairman, the cost of doing nothing is the cost of what we're doing right now. I would just draw the committee's attention to the FY20 premium pay chart. This is produced by the administration. It shows we paid $83 million in overtime, call-out pay, double time, filling shifts in FY20. And if you see in FY25, we were almost at $150 million. And only 6 months into this fiscal year, we were north of $112 million, on track to go over $200 million at that pace. Mr. Chairman, that is an exponential spend rate that is going up. And that is the cost of what we're doing now. And compared with the cost of this bill, it pales in comparison the cost of House Bill 78. Is a very small investment in our workforce, and what we're doing now is very expensive. That's a difference between real budget exposure and an actuarial analysis. Next slide.
Chairman, before we go on, I know you like to jump ahead, but I think if we look at the turnover rate around the nation, which is what we should look at, we'd find that Alaska is not an anomaly. Neither is our education system an anomaly. It's a nationwide trend. These issues here on this chart are all state employees, so we can exclude the municipalities in that discussion and the ones that are scrimping on their employees and not having them in SBS or Social Security. But these factors are significant. If you look at corrections, you look at public safety, these need to be negotiated by the administration in their labor contracts. So we not only need to deal with additive employees to deal with this excessive pay premium to get it under control, regardless of what retirement system we have. And I think that's come to light with a report that hit the chairman's desk here, maybe even
this morning. Thank you, Senator Stedman.
Through the chair. Comments? Thank you, Senator Stedman. I would point out that this chart does not include other PERS employers. So local government is being slaughtered by what we're doing now. Their numbers are far bigger because there's more local government employees. The same dynamics are playing out all across the state. You're absolutely right. How we go about solving this, that's a policy call. But the cost of doing nothing is extraordinary. This slide here shows that this is actually a net revenue positive measure by the most conservative estimates, and I'll explain that. The recruitment and retention, improving savings and training costs, lost workforce hours, and premium pay. So we just saw the premium pay slide for just the state, not local government. But if you look at that gray bar, that is the actuary number for a fully loaded plan, and how it's escalating from 2027 going up as we hire people, fill positions, keep more people in by 2031, what it'll cost. The projected savings is that middle bar, and that is just looking at reduced hiring and training churn and higher investment returns from DB pooling. And that is a very conservative number. We're expecting to get an update on that soon, but we know that's not far off because we know the cost of what we're doing now in premium pay, in errors and omissions, fines from the federal government to our state agencies for not getting SNAP benefits, other public health benefits out on time, on schedule, having to contract financing firms to make payroll for the state, being unable to collect federal reimbursements because we don't have the staffing or the employees with the knowledge to do that. Those measures are orders of magnitude more than this plan is presenting. So I would just say that this is a net revenue positive, and it restores Alaska's ability to provide critically needed services to all Alaskans. Next slide.
Go to the next slide.
Senator Stedman.
We've struggled here with our agencies on their salaries. We have a salary report in. We haven't had the luxury of having it in the middle of the table yet to look at salary increases across the board around the state, particularly the low end. It's salaries that's been been targeted that we need to deal with. So I'd just like to remind the folks of that. And the other thing, when we keep talking about City Hall can put in their own plan. They don't need the state to put in their plan. They can put in their own matching deferred compensation plan. They could increase salaries. They can put in their own defined benefit plan. They don't have to be backed by the Constitution and piggyback on the state's plan. Nobody's forcing them to do that. But they're certainly not volunteering to go out and do their own defined benefit plan. Or, for that matter, doing even matching for deferred comp. There's only a handful, two or three, statewide that do match for deferred comp. Deferred compensation is what I'm referring to.
Senator Kaufman.
Thank you, through the chair. That talking about the payroll, mentioning it there, it brings to mind. So what's the growth assumption in payroll as a percentage?
So through the chair, Senator Kaufman, right now the payroll growth is at 1%.
Senator Kaufman.
Did you adopt that because of the governor's 1% growth proposal?
Through the chair, the 1% is the latest proven trued-up number that we have from Armboard Actuary of State Salaries and what the actual growth is. I'm just giving you what the number is now.
Senator Kaufman.
But I would, through the chair, I would suggest there's serious coiled springs on that. We everywhere, we're hearing all over the state that people are not satisfied with the pay they're getting. There's the payroll study that Senator Stedman brought up. And so that levy may be about to break, and I just wonder if that's an accurate number in payroll growth. It seems like it should be modeled on inflation.
Through the chair, the actuary, Senator Kaufman, the actuary does model, as far as for purposes of this bill, different question, inflation and all that. That would be a better question for the actuary to answer. Mm-hmm. But I'll give you an example. We threw $20 million at the Department of Health Division of Public Assistance. They hired over 100 employees, and they still have some of the highest turnover in state government. So just throwing money at to fill seats isn't keeping people here, and it's not keeping people in the workforce pipeline. What the actuarial analysis shows is that this bill will keep people here. So, yes, you'll grow your payroll, because you have more people filling the vacancies that we all say we're trying to do. We're trying to properly staff the positions that we need. Teachers, we have over 500 teachers on visas in western and northwestern Alaska right now. And is that what we always want to do, or eventually do we want to home grow our talent and grow our numbers of employees in these positions? Same thing with public safety and plow truck operators. So if our goal is to fill vacancies, we will grow payroll, and eventually these people will be around long enough to collect benefits and eventually retire. But what we see now is a rate of churn that's so high that our workforce pipeline is not filling up. People are not retiring.
Senator Kaufman.
Thank you, through the chair to the bill sponsor. You know, in terms of payroll, you can look at the total balance sheet, how many employees at what rate, but also the pay rate of each individual, the per unit cost for an FTE. Of what the escalation is of that separately from whether or not you hire more employees. And so that's where I'm wondering about. Inflation there seems to be some things to look into with inflation with regard to the payout, but also with regard to the assumptions around, how we're going to look at escalation of an individual's pay.
Sure. Thank you, through the chair, Senator Kaufman. I know the actuary is online, and I believe will be coming up next. Great question for him.
Thank you.
So if this is a conservative shared risk design, Mr. Chairman. It has variable employee contributions, conditional inflation proofing, fixed employer caps. They know their cost. The actuary projects no triggers of risk-sharing thresholds will be reached under their assumptions. They're separate accounting, completely keeping everything separate from the legacy trust. There is no COLA. As I mentioned, the health care is unchanged from the DC plan. The higher actuarial cost is simply due to retention, more valuable benefits, and statutory employer caps. So what we see, Mr. Chairman, is that it's very expensive doing doing our current approach. There is no free pass out of this. And Alaska is already committed to paying off our legacy pension obligations, and those payments will continue to go on schedule, whether we reform the system or not. But what is not fixed and what continues to grow every year is the cost of instability in our workforce. Vacancies, overtime, premium pay, recruitment churn, training costs, audit findings, and service failures are all things that have come before this committee. And they don't appear in the actuarial tables, but they do appear in our budget. House Bill 78 addresses this problem upstream. It does with these fixed employer caps, adjustable employee contributions, and conditional inflation provision. It shares risk, it limits exposure, and it aligns Alaska with best practices used in other states. Again, the Gallagher analysis confirms that House Bill 78 provides measurable, transparent, and manageable costs. What cannot be reliably measured, or what is difficult to measure, is the price of a retirement system that fails to retain the people we train, certify, and depend on, and drives up our premium pay and overtime, increases audit findings, fines, and federal reimbursement losses, and destabilizes our economy. Mr. Chairman, I believe this presents a fiscally conservative principle. Finish paying for the past, stop paying for failure in the present, and build a system that works for Alaska's future, not just for us, but for our kids. I recently received an email from a Kodiak Island Borough special education teacher that just moved back to Chicago and said, hey, I hear you have a possible bill to get us back to a pension. And he said, even if my pension was cut in half in Chicago, and it'd be about $6,000 a month, I would come back to Alaska. And I'm thinking, these are the type of people that we want back here. He was a special ed teacher in Kodiak for several years, just went to Chicago because he had a pension, wants to come back home to Alaska. We want these people back in our state, but that's the cost of our system now, losing these people to other states and watching them walk away, not because they don't love Alaska, but because they can't retire here. And this gives us a chance to change that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Before we go to invited testimony, I know everyone has to fill out their financial disclosures, but there's... I would request that you submit yours as early as possible to the public because it may relate to this bill. Yeah. I'm not saying anything else about that. But it's going to come out one way.
No, thank you for asking, Mr. Chairman. So in 2024, I was with the Alaska Public Pension Coalition and helped facilitate. Out of an abundance of caution, I declared it in 2025, even though it was 2024. And the Ledge Ethics Committee found 100% in my favor. Everything I did was fine. I no longer have any connection fiscally, either business or otherwise, with the Pension Coalition. But I'm glad you asked the question. I'm proud to say that I don't have any business affiliation with this. This is something I've been pursuing since I was first elected in 2016.
I just wanted to put that on the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
With that, we will be going to invited testimony. We have one individual that has been invited to testify on House Bill 78, that being David Kirshner. He is online. He's the principal actuarial for Arthur J. Gallagher and Company. Mr. Kirshner, please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your invited testimony.
All right. Thank you very much. Can you hear me okay?
We can hear you loud and clear.
All right. Good afternoon. My name is David Kirshner. I'm a retirement actuary with Gallagher. We have been working with the DRB as the actuary for Alaska's retirement systems since 2006, and I have personally been involved for the last 11 years. I've been asked to discuss today the potential impact on future state contributions to KERS and CHERS due to HB 78. Which is a proposed bill from last year that would reopen the defined benefit pension plans to Alaska's public employees and teachers. The figures that you're going to see in my presentation are the same as what I presented to the House Finance Committee in April of last year, and they are based on a detailed HB 78 fiscal note analysis that we completed in March of 2025.
So before you continue, Ms. Kirshner, we have scheduled till 3:00. If we don't get done by that time, we could certainly bring this bill back before and have your presentation completed, just for your information, time management. Please proceed.
Okay. All right. Thank you. So you have my presentation in front of you. I'm on audio only, so I can't see my presentation, but I'd like to move to slide 3 that shows the contents of my presentation. I'm going to focus today on slides 5 through 23, in particular 14 through 23. The information provided in the appendix is there for additional background information reference for committee members. Moving on to slide 5, I'd like to quickly review the how PERS and TERS are funded, and the Alaska statute specify that employer contributions to PERS are limited to 22% of pay. However, beginning in FY22, the state as an employer began contributing the full actuarial rate, not just 22% of pay, based on the total payroll of its PERS employees. And the payroll of the PERS state employees is about 50% of total PERS payroll. And then TERS employers contribute 12.56%. The member contributions are also specified by statute. You can see there there are three classifications of employees that contribute different percentages of pay. The actuarially determined contribution, you're going to see that term a lot throughout this material, consists of two components. The first component is the normal cost, which is the actuarial cost of benefits that active members are expected to accrue in the upcoming year as they earn an additional year of service. Second component is the past service cost, and that is the amortization or the paying down of the unfunded liability. And based on the methodology that's in place when this analysis was performed, that was a 25-year layered amortization. And just for correction, the payroll growth rate used in these figures was 2.75%, which was set a number of years ago at the inflation rate of 2.5% plus 25 basis points. The reference to a lower payroll growth rate, those were recent changes that the ARM board made, but those lower payroll growth rates are not reflected in these calculations. And as stated earlier, by law, the actuarially determined contribution is calculated separately by trust. So the pension trust and healthcare trust, the assets are legally segregated, and those costs are calculated separately. Moving on to slide 6, how are those actuarially determined contributions paid? Well, the PB normal costs are paid, or the defined benefit normal costs are paid in combination by members and the employers. The employers also contribute various amounts for current defined contribution or DCR retirement plan members. They contribute the actuarial cost for occupational death and disability and health care benefits. They also make contributions to the members' defined contribution or DC accounts, which are 5% for PERS and 7% for TERS, and 3% HRA contribution. A portion of the employer contribution also goes to pay down the past service costs, that unfunded liability for the DB plans. And that amount paid by the employer is equal to their total contribution minus the amount they pay for the DB normal costs and minus the amount that they pay for the DCR members. The DB past service cost that is not paid by the employers is paid by the state via the additional state contributions. Additional state contributions can increase for two reasons, generally for two reasons, assuming that there's no changes in assumptions. The first reason is if the cost of the benefits themselves increase, and the second reason is if there's a change in the distribution of the employer contributions among the various benefits. And these two reasons are why our fiscal note analysis projects increases in state contributions, and we'll see that when we get to the example in a few slides. Moving on to slide 7.
Before we move on to slide 7, we have a question on slide 6 from Senator Stedman.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think we should have retirement benefits or the actuary look at this growth potential in our salaries, because clearly we have a salary study on the table that's going to have to get funded to some mechanism. 1% growth, we all know that's not going to happen because we've got contractual labor contracts at 3 and 5% stepped out for several years. We need a more accurate expectation in the analysis of what we're dealing with here at the table. And we'd jump for joy if there was a 1% growth in salary, except we'd have more turnover. It's going to be definitely higher no matter what retirement plan we have.
Please
There's
proceed.
That. And then I've got one other thing, Mr. Chairman. I'm really curious and concerned with this 22% cap, that there isn't a liability shift to the state from City Hall when the plan goes underfunded. And there's been testimony here that this will never be underfunded, never have a unfunded liability, but that's highly improbable because all they have to do is miss 1 year of targeted rate of return and we're right back to where we were, right? You got to have it perfect every year after year. So I think we need to have the actuary at some point walk through us with the normal cost and comparatively in detail in the normal cost between the plans, and in particular, when the plan starts going underfunded, the new plan, any liability transfer from City Hall to the state.
Thank you. We could get back with Arthur Gallagher and company and set a time for that. Please proceed.
Okay. So on slide 7, the unfunded liability equals the difference between the actuarial accrued liability and the actuarial value of assets. The actuarial accrued liability is the present value of future benefits that are attributable to past service or service as of evaluation date. That's why it's called an accrued liability. And then the actuarial value of assets is a smooth market-related value where the under the smoothing method adopted by the ARM board and statutes is that market gains and losses are recognized in the actuarial value over a five-year period, so we recognize 20% of the market gains and losses each year. Every year, because our calculations of the actuarial accrued liability is based on a series of assumptions, which we believe are our best estimate assumptions over the long term, we know in any given year that our assumptions are not going to be exactly realized. So we're going to have potential changes in unfunded liability that can occur because either the assets do better or worse than we expected, or the liabilities increase or decrease by more or less than we expected based on the changes in the plan participants. We can also have an impact on the unfunded liability if contributions made are greater or less than the actuarially determined contributions. And then finally, we can have changes in the unfunded liability due to changes in assumptions. And as required by Alaska statute, we do evaluate the assumptions once every 4 years. The last time the assumptions were changed was effective 2022, and we're currently evaluating the assumptions as part of the new four-year experience study, and new assumptions will be discussed with the ARM board at the next meeting and then potentially adopted effective for the 2026 evaluations. In the appendix, we've provided a couple of slides that show the key reasons for why the PERS and TERS pension unfunded liabilities changed between over a 10-year period from 2014 to 2024. I believe that information could help respond or answer some of the questions that I've heard at this and other meetings, but I don't, due to time, I don't plan on going through that today. Moving on to slide 8, the funding methodology was established by statutes in 2014. The unfunded liability amortization was changed from level dollar to level percentage of pay. Level dollar is like paying off your home mortgage where you pay the same amount every year or every month. Under level percentage of pay, the amortization amount increase each year as the payroll growth is payroll is expected to increase. And as I said, these calculations were based on the 2.75% payroll growth rate that had been in effect for many years. The amortization period was reset to a closed 25-year period from 2014, which is why 2039 has been our magic target date for when the trusts were projected to be 100% funded. And there were a couple of other changes made to the contribution rate setting process and the actuarialized assets. On slide 9, the ARM board made other significant changes in 2018 when they introduced what we call a layered amortization methodology. And the reason for a layered amortization methodology was to limit the potential impact on future contributions that the state would incur if we maintain that original 25-year period. Under a layered amortization methodology, each year's unexpected change in the unfunded liability, either positive or negative, is then amortized over a separate 25-year period, and then the total amortization is the sum of all the individual amortization layers. When layered amortization was introduced, the amortization period for the remaining unfunded liability from 2014 was not changed. So that unfunded liability from 2014 is still going to be fully amortized by 2039. And again, in the appendix are some details on additional background on the assumptions that we use for the valuations as well as the assumptions that we use for our HB 78 cost analysis.
Senator Stedman.
Moving on.
Thank you, Mr.
Sorry,
Chair.
Do you have a question?
Yes, Senator Stedman.
Yes, thank you. I'm having a concept challenge here because I keep hearing that through these presentations that taking care of the pension is going to be really easy, that it's not going to be underfunded, and there's this, doesn't matter how it's split, just in the aggregate, right? All you're doing is sharing the cost if it goes underfunded, and it's predictable. But when I looked at the presentation this morning, after the billion that went into the PERS unfunded liability in 2015, and the $2 billion in the TERS. So now we fast forward to FY25. In PERS, we owed $4.4 billion. That was after the infusion of a billion. And today, the last numbers I have is 25. It's $5.1 billion. Well, from 4.4 to 5.1, you're going backwards. Then if we go to TERS, over the same time frame, they're showing after the $2 billion infusion. And in 2015, we're at $1,629. And ironically, in FY25, we're at $1,629. So we've spent a decade dealing with something as simple as a pension liability, as the way it's being presented here. And our liability, Mr. Chairman, is the same spot. And we've spent several billion dollars trying to move it down. So I think we're getting some stuff's not as simple and easy as it appears. And that was the presentation this morning at this finance table. And the discussion that we're going to have coming up at the table and inviting the actuaries' help, because we're going to need help, is this amortization period discussion of 15 years to 25. Because we need to get this retired. And if I can make one other quick comment, and then I'll zip my lip for a minute, I'll repeat what was put on the table this morning. If you were born in 1980, went to work in 2005, you're 25 years old, now it's 26, so we'll just round it off and say it's 25. you know, you'd be halfway through your working career at 20 years in, and you've been burdened by this unfunded liability for your entire working career, and now we got 20 more years without adding any more, just what we got in front of us, 20 more years. So your entire, if you were born in 1980, your entire working career has been burdened by this unfunded liability. That is not what we should be doing to our future generations, even though these liabilities, benefits were accrued in 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. Certainly the child born in 1980 had nothing to do with it. So I'm very concerned when we look at the pension plan and we say, well, we don't have to worry about it. It's never going to go unfunded. We had that presentation this morning that says we're in the same spot we were 10 years ago in dollars. The funding ratio has improved because the portfolio has gotten bigger and so on and so forth. But the dollars owed that we have to pay at this table is still there. Anyway, that's just a repeat from this morning, Mr. Chairman. I know you don't want to hear it twice.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Maybe I shouldn't say thank you, but yeah. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Real numbers are hard, and realities, fiscal realities, are hard, and they can be painful. And the simple fact is that, that you know, all these things have an impact, all these things have an effect, and some of the things that the bill sponsor talked about in terms of the costs we're all bearing as we appropriate money to these agencies that can't get their overtime under control because they can't keep their employees, that's reflected in some of our pension choices too. Now, we're not putting those dollars into a trust fund with an actuarial funded ratio. We're putting those dollars into the operating budget. We're putting those dollars into another 5.5% UGF cost overrun in the form of a supplemental Department of Corrections. Again, not for the first time, because they can't get staffed up. So, Mr. Chairman, we are bearing costs. There's no question about it. And the Alaskans we serve are bearing those costs. Certainly, we've got a couple of folks who work in schools around the building who might talk to us about what's going on because we can't keep teachers. And I'm not going to belabor this point forever, but I think it's fair to ask where we can save a dollar by investing a dollar. We don't even have to talk about the individuals who have a personal account and no pension to count on, and what the unfortunate investment market returns and the reflections that things that we see reflected in the actuaries bringing down that return assumption from 8.25% to 7.25% means for them, but it sure doesn't mean they're retiring fat and happy. So, Mr. Chairman, there are costs all over the place, and we should definitely talk about where we bear costs and where we bear risks, but only one of those happens to come with a funded ratio that we can put on a piece of paper. That doesn't mean it's the only place we need to look. So I think it's a worthwhile conversation, but I would hate for us ever to run the risk of getting myopic and thinking that the only costs are in the pension plan because Alaskans are bearing them all over the place.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Mr. Kirshner, please proceed.
All right. Thank you. So in the interest of time, which we don't have much of, I'm going to jump ahead to slide 16, and I'd like to just explain, like I said, there's two reasons why we are projecting state contributions to increase. The first reason is because the underlying benefits that HB 78 members would receive are more valuable than they currently receive as a DCR member, and therefore more costly. We've shown you there what the laid out the costs are. The second reason on slide 17 is the additional cost due to HB 78 fall directly to the state. And we're going to see that when we look at an example, which we've shown beginning on slide 19. Slide 19 shows bar charts that compare the cost of, we chose FY 30, 5 years after HB 78 was projected to be, was proposed to be effective. We've shown for FY30 the cost of benefits as a percentage of pay for DCR members versus HB 78. The graph on the left is for PERS. The graph on the right is for TERS. If we look at PERS on the in the DCR column, we start with the dark blue, which is the cost, the actual cost of the occupational death and disability benefits. The light blue is the cost of the health care. The orange is the defined contribution, in this case 5%. And then the green is the 3% HRA. So currently, or for the FY30, the DCR costs are 9.17% of pay for PERS DCR members. If we move to the next bar under HB 78, we have three cost components. We have, for these members, we have their health care benefits in the light blue. And the reason why the health care benefits, even though the underlying health care benefits are the same as what they currently receive, because we are expecting higher employee retention, that means when we do our projections, we're projecting more health care benefit recipients in the future under the HB 78 arrangement, and therefore the actuarial cost is higher. Then we add the yellow or gold box, which is the cost of the HB 78 members' pension benefits, and then their HRA costs in green. So this, for PERS, the HB 78 member cost is the percentage of their pay is projected to be 11.78. So you can see 9.17 currently, 11.78% of pay under HB 78, and then PERS increases from 10.74 to 11.42. Then so, on the next slide,
Can you stay on this slide, Mr. Kirshner? The title of it is FY30 Cost of Underlying Benefits, but it's actually the percentage costs. Can you get us a slide that we can look at that shows the costs and not only the percentage costs for the committee's review in the future? Thank you. Please proceed.
You mean the dollar cost?
Yes.
Yes, we can do that.
Thank you.
Sure. Then on slide 20, we take the costs from slide 19 and convert them to a total plan basis, total pay basis, because all of the additional state contributions are determined on a total pay basis. So we have to convert everything to a total pay basis, and you can see that's what's shown on slide 20. Again, the cost for DCR on a total pay basis is expected to increase from 7.67 to 10.09 for PERS and 8.92 to 9.55 for TERS. On slide 21, we've shown the components of the actuarially determined contribution rate. Under the current plan, we have the pension as normal cost for pension benefits for legacy DB members in dark blue, the legacy DB cost for the healthcare in light blue, the green is the legacy unfunded liability, and then the gray is the HRA contribution. And then on the right, you can see we've done the same thing, except we've added in the cost of the HB 78 members' pension benefits in orange, and in yellow or gold, the HB 78 members' health care benefits. You can see for PERS, the total actuarial rate is expected to increase from 29.16% of total pay to 30.22. For TERS, it's actually projected to decrease ever so slightly. Then moving on to slide 22, we put all of these percentages together to then calculate the projected state contributions. Slide 22 is the development of the state as an employer contribution under PERS for FY30. The first line shows the total projected pay, and you can see the current projected pay is expected to increase by about 5% because of that higher expected employee retention. Vita 1878. We've got the legacy DB members, actuarial rates, the normal costs, and the past service. Then we add the DCR rate, which is set currently 7.67 that we just saw. It's zero under HB 78 because we've assumed, as the plan sponsor mentioned in his remarks, our calculations are based on the assumption that all eligible DCR members elect to transfer to the DB plan under our analysis. And then the next section, we add in the HB 78 members' ADC rate, the actual rate. And you can see it's NA currently, and then you can see the pension rate, the healthcare rate, and the HRA rate. So when we add up all the three different rates, currently we're at 29.16 versus 30.22. We then multiply those rates times the projected pay to get the total estimated contributions at the bottom. And then I know we're almost out of time, so I'll quickly move to slide 23.
On 22, we have a question from Senator Stedman on slide 22.
Thank you, Mr. Kirshner. I was wondering if you've been asked to run the analysis to see what, out of the defined contribution plan, how many members are overfunded or underfunded when you look at the conversion, so we can get an idea. Have you been asked to do that analysis lately, so we had some current data on that?
Through the chair, Senator Simmons, you mean when you say over or underfunded, you mean how many DCR members will be able to purchase all of their service in the DB plan? Is that what you mean?
Yes, and they could have a surplus, and then we haven't talked about what comes about that, because this is just introducing this bill. And then how many folks would be under, would have to come up with the catch-up plan or whatever, if that's what they want to do. Has that analysis been run?
Yes, we did do that. Those details are shown in our March 29 fiscal note letter. But I can tell you, let me just scroll through it quickly. Based on our calculation, we in FERS, peace officers, firefighters, we have 2,711 active in 2024, and we said of those four, about 74% of their service would be purchased by their DC account. 446 of those members were projected to have all of their service purchased. The PERS others, of the 24,100 members, about 12,000 were projected to have enough money in their DC account to purchase all their service, and about 86% is the average percentage. And then for TERS, of the 6,200 active members, about 3,600 were projected to have enough in their DC account to purchase all their service. On average, about 92% of TERS service was purchasable by their DC account.
That's fine. Senator Stedman?
That's fine. That's older data. I think we need some newer numbers run. That was data that was accumulated and presented in March. That's a year ago almost. And then the leg to get the data. It would be nice to have as fresh a data on such an important issue as possible. But it appears that there will be a high percentage of members that are overfunded.
Please proceed, Mr. Kirshner.
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Stedman, yes, I agree. And in fact, we are in discussions with DRB on updating our fiscal note analysis to be based on more current data, which would be, in this case, 2025 data.
Okay, thank you.
So continuing on slide 23, we've shown you the development of the additional state contributions for fiscal year 2030. The left box on the left is for PERS. The box on the right is for TERS. And I'll walk through the calculations for PERS. It's the same or very similar for TERS. Again, we have our projected pay. Now, in this case, for PERS, this is for non-state employers only, because, as I said, the state as an employer pays the full rate and is not subject to the 22% limit. So this is just for PERS non-state employers. We have the current DB members, the legacy DB members, actuarial rate, and you can see it's projected to decrease from 21.49% to 20.13%. As the plan sponsor mentioned in his remarks earlier, the DB plan costs are not affected at all. The dollar amount of the costs are not affected for the legacy DB members by HB 78. But when we divide the same dollar amounts by a higher payroll, as shown in the top line, the percentage comes down a little bit. So that's the only reason why the current DB members' actuarial rate decreases, because the total pay, our denominator, is increased. Then we have we add in the DCR rate, and then we add in the HB 78 members' ADC rate, which includes the HRA contribution. So you can see the total ADC rate, the same numbers we just saw earlier, 29.16 versus 30.22. We subtract the statutory rate of 22% to get the additional state contribution rate. You can see that we have it before an interest adjustment and after. The reason why we have that interest adjustment is because all of the rates above the ABC rates include an interest adjustment to take into account the fact that employer contributions come in throughout the year, every payroll period, whereas the additional state contributions are typically contributed to the trust at the beginning of the fiscal year. So we have to back out that interest adjustment. So we use the after interest adjustment rates times the projected pay from the top line to get those additional state contributions. So you can see PERS additional state contribution for FY30 projected to increase from 99 to 120 million. And then TERS is done the same way. It's just that the statutory rate is 12.56, but the mechanics are exactly the same for TERS as they are for PERS. And that is the end of my prepared remarks. I'd be happy to entertain other questions.
Any additional questions? Thank you for that presentation. Can the prime sponsor come forward? Do you have any closing comments before we set this bill aside?
Thank you, Chair Hoffman. I very much appreciate the committee's giving us the opportunity to present this policy. And I would just say that I believe the actuary supports the initial rollout of the bill, and I'm very grateful for this opportunity to finally be here and bring it before you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. That concludes this afternoon's meeting. Our next scheduled meeting is tomorrow, Tuesday at 9 a.m. here in the Senate Finance Room. We will be hearing from Alaska's Mental Health Trust. Seeing nothing else to come before the committee, we are adjourned.